Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue to order. I apologize for our lack of attendance here. We normally start at 8:30 and people get into habits. So we have a very full agenda today. So I wanted to start as a basically a subcommittee without a quorum to get a couple of things taken care of. And then when we have our quorum here, we'll do bill introduction. So I wanted to start off by welcoming our new economist, Vijay Satyal. Did I say that? Vijay Satyal, who comes to us from the Department of Energy. And Paul, maybe you could say a few words about Vijay's background.
Okay. Madam Chair, we conducted a national search and advertised in the job openings for economists. We got over 30 applicants and from around the country, and we from Florida to D.C. So we had a pretty good group, and yet we found our best candidate was close to home. So we were glad that Vijay was available, and he's done good work for Department of Energy. Comes to us via Oregon State University, which is a pretty good school. And so we're having his. We divided our economists in subject areas, and the areas that Vijay will be focusing on for the session and the 15th session are, first of all, personal income tax. We've been kind of overloading Chris, and we thought this might help restore his calm and cool, collected nature. We gave him some help in the income tax area, and also tobacco taxes and estate taxes. Oh. So those will be the three areas that the Vijay will be concentrating on.
So our regular vice person has been divested of one of his biggest vices. You'll have to put the Tabasco sign on Vijay's office. So welcome. We look forward to working with you, and we actually know you a little bit from your work with the Department of Energy. Thank you. Okay, so should we just move right into
that? Yeah, we can
go ahead. Okay, we're going to go ahead and start our informational meeting. There are people around the building watching on TV, so don't be misled by the small attendance here. This subject matter that we're about to address is of high interest in the building, and I know that a lot of TV sets are turned on to it. So, Paul?
Madam Chair, we've invited two experts from out of state and to look at some of the activities that other states have done around cap and trade policies. And they are here. Sue Tierney's here from the analysis group, and Michael Gibbs from the California Air Resources Board. And I'll ask Mazen to come up. Mazen is heading our study that was given to us from Senate Bill 306 on the feasibility of a carbon fee or tax.
Great. Come on aboard, Mazen. Should we just go ahead and call our witnesses?
Yes.
Okay, why don't we have Ms. Tierney and Mr. Gibbs come on up and start their presentation. I want to welcome you to Oregon. We have a lot of greenhouse fog in Portland today, I understand. I hope it didn't hold you back on your travels. Wanted to welcome you here and thank you for coming all this way to educate us on this issue.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. I'm Sue Tierney, and it's great to be here. I'm coming from Boston, and I don't mind the fog. It's just great. I have a presentation that I have distributed to the committee previously. I will go through some of the highlights from the presentation, not every slide, but I'll be happy to answer any questions on more depth. Additionally, I provided a six-page statement of description of the program that I'm about to describe. In 2011, at the end of the year, colleagues of mine and I at Analysis Group did a study of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative Program, a program carried out by 10 states in the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast area of the United States to control greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector and to do so through a mechanism that would set a price on carbon. So I'm going to describe that. We published our paper. It's available for those of you who need sleep at night. Let me describe the program because, as you'll hear, it's going to be a little bit different from the California program that Michael is going to describe. The Northeast states started in the early, about a decade ago, talking about how they would control greenhouse gas emissions from power plant operations. The regions have states which individually had set climate emissions reductions targets over the next few years and eventually adopted a memorandum of understanding through which they would establish a regional market for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The electric systems in this area are interconnected across state lines, and so there's a lot of power flow in the area, and that was the topic that they were going to be focusing on. After setting and agreeing to a memorandum of understanding, each state adopted its own implementing laws to put this in place. And let me just describe the framework because the mechanics of it are important for understanding the dollar flows, which may be of interest to the committee, as well as the greenhouse gas emissions reductions. So in this framework, there is a ceiling or a maximum amount of greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide that can be emitted from power plant operations. Fossil fuel power plants, coal plants, natural gas plants and oil plants are the subject of this regulation. And there's a cap on the amount that the 10 states' power plants can emit in any year. And over time, that ceiling or that cap reduces over time. Then the states developed or created a new currency that they would issue into the marketplace. The currency is one allowance per ton of carbon dioxide emissions. And anybody who is in the power sector who wanted to be emitting greenhouse gases or carbon dioxide had to have an allowance for every ton that is emitted at the end of a year or at the end of a three-year period associated with their use of fossil fuels. The states in adopting this program left to each state the opportunity to figure out how to get those allowances into the hands of power plant owners. And eventually, each state independently decided that what they would do was auction them. So they jointly set up a quarterly auction in which the states share, each state's share of those allowances, their budget, if you will, of the greenhouse gas emissions would be pooled and there was a very mechanical auction mechanism. Michael and I were talking. This isn't one of the places where the auction guy says, you know, what's your price? It's very electronic, very sophisticated. And the power generators bid a price for their willingness to pay for an allowance for the right to emit carbon dioxide. In doing that, then the states received the proceeds from their sale of those allowances into the marketplace. And then the question was, what do states do with that money? And our study examined what states actually did do with the money to track what happened to it in terms of how it affected the economic impacts in the 10-state area. So let me describe that. The one or two more words about the agreement across the states. Each state was very fearful of losing its sovereignty, and so they wanted to agree to disagree potentially on how they'd spend money, and you'll see that they did spend it in different ways. But one of the things that they agreed upon was that at a minimum, 25% of the dollars they collected in any auction would go for public purpose, and they defined that in lots of different ways. So how the states actually spent their money is shown on this chart, and I better give you some names of the states. The colors are important. So if you see Maryland on the top left, Maryland's light blue color represents almost two-thirds of the amount of Maryland's proceeds from the auctions over 3 years period of time. And Maryland decided to use most of the money to collect and put a credit on electricity customers' bills so that electricity consumers who were buying electricity that had a slightly higher price because of having a carbon allowance built into the price of electricity, they then got a bill payment or a credit on each monthly bill to compensate or address that issue. Not very many of the states use the money that way. A contrast is New Jersey, New Hampshire, and New York that have a darker blue for a larger piece of their pie. And that darker blue was simply use of the money for general fund purposes. So it just went to the general fund and became part of the pot of revenues that the state collected and used and applied for funding the budget of the state. The red color is the other noticeable color on these pie charts, and you'll see that most of the states, or most of the money altogether, was spent on energy efficiency programs. So in this sense, what you can think of this is that electricity consumers ended up paying for electricity that had a slightly 0.7% increase in the price of electricity, as it turned out, and that money then was used to offset the portion of electricity bills that would have otherwise been collected by electric utilities to fund energy efficiency programs. So this was offsetting a piece of the customer bill, and most of those states that you see big red piece then were reinvesting in the electric system money that had been collected from the electric system for investment in lowering the price of electricity, lowering usage of electricity over time. So that is what we studied in this. I won't really describe our study unless you'd like to, but let me tell you that what we did was follow the money. So what we did was we looked at exactly how much money had been collected by the auctions over 12 quarters of the first 3 years of this program. The auction proceeds are given to the states. They had to figure out how to program that money in each of these quarters over 3 years period of time. They move the money into the economy in one way or the other. And depending upon how they decided to spend it, it did have different economic impacts on their different state economies. I won't go through the model, but I'm happy to describe any part of it that you'd like to see. But what we really did in essence was we knew the real world that people experienced over 3 years was the world in which this program was in place. So we had to develop a simulated world in which there had been no collection of a carbon fee nor impact on price of electricity. The use of power plants changed because of having a fee on fossil fuels. Carbon is produced doubly by coal plants compared to other fossil fuel power plants. So this had a higher impact on a coal-fired power plant and its use as compared to a natural gas plant, or frankly, a renewable energy project or a nuclear project that has zero carbon. So those became more valuable sources of electricity in this model. So the punchline of what we found out is that over 3 years, these 10 states, which are represent, I think, a fifth of the national economy, collected $912 million in the sale of these allowances into the marketplace. They used that money, as I described, in many different ways, and over time, the economic spillover effect of spending that money in the 10 states led to $1.6 billion in economic value and 16,000 jobs done locally. Now, this is a part of the country that does not produce a lot of fossil fuels, so one of the things that happened was using less fossil fuel to produce electricity meant that there was less money going out of state to purchase out of state fossil fuels. So that money stayed inside the region. For example, people were hired to put on insulation and other things for energy efficiency. People were hired as part of state programs and a variety of other things. So that money stayed in the local economy and had spillover effects. I described that electricity prices went up a little bit in the beginning. 0.7%, so less than 1%. That was at the beginning, but as money started becoming invested in energy efficiency, energy usage went down, the power sector used fewer of the more expensive power plants to operate to produce electricity, and everybody in the region benefited by having an electric supply that didn't cost as much money to produce electricity. So that was one of the biggest sources of the savings that consumers had. Electricity consumers, while they had a short-term impact of less than 1% in their prices to pay for that fee, in essence, over time, there was $1.1 billion in lower electricity costs over the period that we modeled. So think about that. We studied what actually happened in 3 years, but because an energy efficiency investment stays in place in a person's home or a building for many years, you look at the tail end effects of those investments, and it was a huge payoff of value. I think I'm going to just point you your attention to any of a number of slides that describe this and go to a couple of the punchlines. One of the things that mattered in this particular program was the decision to auction the allowances. Now, there are some programs where there's a fee, in essence, for polluting through power generation. For example, the sulfur dioxide program is a program of the federal government, been in place for 20 years. That program essentially involves giving the allowances away for free to owners of power plants. And those owners of power plants, in effect, end up pricing that into their price of electricity anyway. And so, in some sense, that's a windfall profit to owners of power plants with the first gift of the allowance to them. In this sense, the power generators had to buy them. They had to buy every single one of them. They did price them into the price of electricity. Consumers paid that cost, as I described. But in essence, the states got the value associated with selling the allowance that they created in the first place. So that was one thing that was important, but states had the right to choose, and the states could have done it differently across the 10 states. The other thing that was important was that this was a really interesting laboratory because there were 10 states, and they decided to spend it in a lot of different ways. So we could really follow exactly the effect of spending in different ways. And as you know, a dollar spent in one kind of activity in the state has a different kind of multiplier effect than other things. And so we were able to track that. We were a little bit worried that there would be one state that had a net economic loss, but it didn't happen. But the biggest gainers were those who spent their money on energy efficiency for the reasons that I described. So I think what I'll do is I will leave it there and be happy to talk about any of these things in greater detail.
I really appreciate that, and I appreciate the brevity, but the overall picture that you're giving us. I just did have one brief question, and that is, you said they stayed away from the higher cost energy producers. What were those?
So in the electric system, there's always a portfolio of power plants. Some of them run around the clock, and you know they're slow to start up, but once they're operating, they're cheap to operate. A nuclear plant would be that. Some coal plants have historically been like that. There are other plants that the grid operator, the utility, turns on a dime, boom, when electric use is at its peak. Those are expensive to operate. They're usually a relatively inefficient, cheap to build plant, but they operate quickly. Those are jet engines in some circumstance. They're typically fossil fuels to operate. So if you use those less, the power producers spending less and having to charge less.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Any other quick questions before we move on?
Just a quick one. Thanks, Madam Chair. And Ms. Tierney, I was struck by that 16,000 jobs created figure. Can you talk a little more about what types of jobs those were?
So let's see if I can move this back up quickly. Maybe here. So this busy chart is a description of how money ended up being spent. And the principal thing that money was spent on was, as I said, energy efficiency programs. So imagine what that involves. That involves, in the first instance, hiring people to set up a program. So, you know, wonks like us might be hired to do that kind of thing. Secondly, the utility then is subcontracting often with installers of equipment, people who do audits in industrial buildings, people who sell light bulbs that are efficient, all sorts of things, including installing solar panels in some instances. So there's a lot of local job content associated with that. Now, I said, compare that with a power plant. The power plant's already built. You have to get fuel from out of state to operate the plant. So that is a different kind of job effect compared to installing energy efficiency. So there's a lot of different jobs like that. Some of these were temporary jobs. In essence, you know, once that particular program is offered, then you go to a different house and install the same kind of equipment, and those don't keep going on forever. But there are a variety of things like that.
Great, thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's move on.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Michael Gibbs. I'm with the California Air Resources Board. My pleasure to be here this morning. Certainly as neighbors, California and Oregon share an interconnected transportation system, electric grid, fuel supplies, and we have and we continue to collaborate on important energy and environmental programs that benefit the residents of our two states. As we in California have built upon the experience and lessons of others, and in particular the experience in the REGI program that you were just hearing about, so it's appropriate that you heard first about that. I'm hopeful that our experience as well in California will be useful to you as you consider timely and effective climate action. I'd like to provide a general summary of California's approach to reducing emissions of these greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and the other gases, and then I'll provide additional detail on our cap and trade program. So just as a general overview, as you're probably aware, California enacted the Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006, which is commonly referred to as AB 32, and that directed my agency, the Air Resources Board, to develop a comprehensive plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It set a limit of emissions for the year 2020 at 1990 levels and directed us to continue reducing emissions after 2020. We developed and adopted a blueprint for how we would achieve this, and that blueprint is called our scoping plan, which was adopted in 2008, and it laid out a portfolio of programs that collectively were estimated to deliver the emissions reductions that were called for in the Act. We calculated that we should be able to do that both cost-effectively and affordably and establish a long-term emissions reduction strategy. So at this point, we're pleased to be able to report that the programs defined in our scoping plan have been adopted and are up and running and appear to be working. When we say they appear to be working, we're looking at what's actually happening to emissions. And I think we're all aware of what the recession did to emissions in all of our states and across the country. But recent evidence, we think, suggests that our programs are, in fact, reducing emissions as they were designed to do. Since the recession, economic indicators in California are up, including gross state product, total employment, manufacturing employment, private sector wages, and our population continues to grow. Nonetheless, greenhouse gas emissions have continued to decline as the economy has recovered. Although significant emissions reductions remain to be achieved in order for us to meet our target, it appears as though we are on track to achieve our 2020 goals. So that's good news, I think, for our programs. So reflecting the nature of the climate problem, our strategy has been to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in a comprehensive manner, integrating our efforts with our air quality programs. Similar to conditions here in Oregon, the transportation sector is the largest source of emissions in California, followed by the electricity sector, including emissions that are from in-state generation in California, as well as emissions associated with electricity that's imported from outside of our state. Next come industrial emissions from a variety of sources, including refineries, cement production, oil and gas exploration, and even food processing. And finally, commercial and residential buildings and appliances. Interestingly, the fastest growing source of emissions in California, and I suspect here in Oregon as well, has been gases with what are called high global warming potentials, those that on an individual mass basis have the largest impact on climate. And those tend to be refrigerants that are used in course, refrigerators and air conditioners, and in certain industrial applications. Although they're a relatively small portion of emissions, these high GWP gases would grow to be a significant source if left unchecked. So California has in place a set of programs to address each of these emissions, and I want to highlight several of them and then get to the cap and trade program and how that works and some of the differences with REGI. So first, the Advanced Clean Cars Program addresses emissions from vehicles. We've most recently approved regulations in 2012 that take effect in 2017 that will require by 2025 15% of all passenger vehicles offered for sale be zero emissions vehicles, either plug-in electrics, full battery electrics, or hydrogen fuel cells. These vehicles are already starting to hit the market. The state's zero emissions vehicle requirement is expected to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in California by up to 52 million tons in 2025. We continue to encourage other states to use their own authority to adopt these standards, and we certainly commend Oregon in its leadership in this area of promoting advanced clean cars. In the fuels area, we have our low carbon fuel standard, which addresses emissions from transportation fuels. The program called Low Carbon Fuel Standard, or LCFS, has a target to reduce by 10% the carbon intensity of transportation fuels by 2020, while also providing a variety of sustainable clean fuel choices for Californians. It's designed to encourage an orderly transition to cleaner, more sustainable fuels. No fuel is banned and no fuel is disadvantaged by virtue of being produced outside of California. I can go into more detail on how that works if you like, but each type of fuel is assigned a value, which is compared against a baseline. When the program started in 2011, there were 27 definitions of fuel pathways. Each had characteristics. Now there's nearly 150 that have been defined, so there's quite a diverse set of fuels that are available. We're, of course, continuing to pursue energy efficiency, which has many benefits, and including providing cost-effective emissions reductions. We have building and appliance standards and customer-oriented information and incentive programs. And I know that Oregon is also very active in this area. We have very aggressive renewable electricity programs to decarbonize our electricity supply, providing air quality benefits as well as diversifying our electricity sources. The California utilities have achieved the state's 20% renewable standard, which means that at least 20% of the state's electricity is already being delivered from qualifying renewable sources, and are well on the way to achieving the requirement that by 2020, 33% of the electricity delivered in the state would come from qualifying renewable sources. Additionally, the state is continuing incentives for customer-installed renewables. So before turning to the cap and trade program, I just want to mention that we have a couple other smaller programs. We do have a refrigerant management program addressing those high GWP gases that I mentioned. We're focused on sustainable communities and integrated planning to reduce the demand for vehicle miles traveled. We're developing a comprehensive freight strategy that will improve efficiency and reduce the cost of moving goods. And we've strengthened our landfill gas requirements to reduce methane emissions. So now I'd like to turn to the cap and trade program, which is a fundamental part of our overall strategy. The cap and trade program ensures that the state will reduce its emissions to achieve our emissions goal. It creates a declining emissions cap, so there's a cap on emissions, that covers about 85% of the state's emissions, including emissions associated with electricity that's imported into the state. The declining cap and the corresponding cost of allowances provides an ongoing incentive for on-site efficiency improvements, the installation of new, more efficient facilities and equipment, and, of course, innovation to reduce emissions. A portion of the allowances, and you heard a description about what allowances are, and one allowance is equal to a ton of emissions. The proceeds from our auctioning of allowances provides funding for investments that further reduce emissions. And the enforceable emissions cap ensures that the combined effect of all these programs is to actually reduce emissions to the levels that we have targeted. The program is up and running. 2013, last year, was the first year of emissions covered by the program. It incorporates our rigorous emissions reporting program, where each of the emitters has to report annually what their emissions are. And those emissions reports must be independently third-party verified to ensure their accuracy. All entities that are covered by the cap and trade program which are those with emissions of 25,000 metric tons a year or more, are required to obtain and then surrender these emission allowances in equal measure to their emissions. So they have to cover all their emissions with their allowances. There are about 600 entities in the program, in other words, 600 emitters and electricity importers, which collectively are owned and operated by about 300 companies. So there's about 600 emitters, 300 companies. At the start of the program, industrial emitters, which are covered, receive for free a substantial portion of their allowances that they need for compliance. The free allowances decline over time, so that over time they don't get so many, and they have to acquire them. And the purposes of providing the free allowances were twofold. One, to provide a transition into the program so there would not be an abrupt impact. But second, to reduce the risk that some emissions from in-state production might just move out of state and be produced out of state, and that would be emissions leakage. So we want to ensure that the production can stay in the state and still reduce emissions and not just move out of state. So a portion of those free allowances are directed toward those industries that we call our trade exposed that would otherwise face this competition. The electricity sector is also covered. The allowances for this sector are sold at auction, a similar result to what you heard about with Reggie. But the proceeds from the auction of those allowances are used to benefit electricity ratepayers. So we've made the decision in California to auction them, and that the proceeds associated with those allowances are used to benefit electricity ratepayers. The electricity generators and importers must purchase the allowances to comply with the program. They're not given anything for free. Transportation fuels will be covered by the program starting next year, in 2015. All the allowances associated with transportation fuels will be auctioned, and no free allowances are being provided for those emissions. Similarly, natural gas suppliers to residential and commercial customers are also covered starting next year, but those entities who deliver that natural gas will receive at the beginning free allowances, which will then again decline over time for the same reasons. So while we're still at the beginning of our cap and trade program, we see evidence that it's already starting to reduce emissions. Under the careful watch of the California Independent System Operator, that's the organization that manages the overwhelming majority of the California electric grid, the California Independent System Operator, we see that the allowance prices have already translated into the day-ahead market prices for electricity. So the allowance prices have had their effect on electricity prices, and this is proof that the allowance prices are affecting the offers that are made to supply electricity, leading to the preferential use of the lower emitting units. So you already heard that within the fleet of units, the fleet of generators that supply electricity to California, there's a range of efficiencies and costs. And by imposing this carbon cost, this emissions fee, on the generation of these emissions, it leads to the more frequent use of the more efficient and less emitting portions of the fleet rather than the higher emitting portions of the fleet. So these effects are documented in that system operator's quarterly market monitoring reports. In the industrial sector, it's too soon to actually measure the effect that the program's had on emissions. It's only been a year. So what we can report today is just based on discussions that we have with folks who are managing the facilities. And what we're seeing is improved efficiencies and some investments to reduce emissions in those facilities. For example, one of the things we've seen is the increased use of biomass as energy in cement kilns. So cement kilns are a big source of emissions in the state, and we're starting to see the substitution of more biomass for fossil fuels there. So before closing, I'd just like to say a few words about some of the reasons why California chose to adopt a cap-and-trade program. We believe that pricing carbon emissions is a powerful tool to provide incentives to reduce emissions, and we acknowledge that pricing can be done in different ways, of course, with a fee or a tax or with a cap-and-trade type of program. And we applaud efforts to price carbon emissions effectively, whichever method is used, because it can be effective in each of its forms. Nonetheless, in California, we chose to approach it using a cap-and-trade program, and I thought I might just mention a couple of the reasons why. Perhaps most importantly, the cap-and-trade program is designed and managed to reliably achieve our primary goal of reducing emissions, reducing them to, at, or below the state's emissions target. Because the declining cap provides a clear and enforceable limit you know that you're going to reach the actual emissions limit that you set. So that was an important factor in selecting this approach within California. By creating emission allowances, the program creates value. And you heard how some of that value is used in REGI. And so by allocating the allowances, you can direct the value to specific uses. As I mentioned, in the electric sector, the value is directed to electricity ratepayers. What it does is it offsets the higher price for electricity in a similar manner that was described before. For those trade-exposed industries, it reduces the risk of emissions leakage. And for those that are auctioned by the state and the proceeds retained by the state, it enables the state to invest in additional actions to reduce emissions. And the state has developed a 3-year investment plan to support the objectives of AB 32. And the way that works is the legislature enacted a requirement that the Department of Finance develop a 3-year plan laying out the types of investments that would be appropriate. And the legislature then has to appropriate those funds each year for those projects. And so the legislature, in the budget process, retains authority over how the funds get used. We haven't spent the money yet, so we can't report how it's been used and what the effects have been. So finally, I would say that we realize that no one state or one country, for that matter, can solve our climate challenge. We require concerted action, timely and effective action, action that can reliably reduce emissions to target levels. And we believe that cap and trade is a program that is scalable across jurisdictions. Among the key benefits of the cap and trade program is that when jurisdictions link their programs together, they all face the same carbon price. And we think this is a particularly powerful outcome. The 10 REGI states got together and decided to do a program together, and when they did that, they all faced the same carbon price. And so that eliminates the risk that one state might accidentally have a higher price than someone else, or prevents a race to the bottom where some states are trying to get the lowest carbon price to try to attract business or something. And so we think that that's an important aspect of linking cap and trade programs, is as you have a growing comprehensive cap and trade program that involves more jurisdictions, and as more jurisdictions join, they all face the same carbon price. They're all seeing the same thing. So linking cap and trade programs is a reality. It's not just REGI. In California, we've linked our program with a similar program in Quebec, and we started that on January 1st of this year. And so these programs are demonstrating how compatible cap and trade programs can link together. So those are a couple of reasons why California went that route, again, recognizing that there's various ways that it can be accomplished. So I'll stop here. Thanks again for having me. I commend you for your thoughtful approach to considering climate action and pricing carbon. I look forward to additional discussions and happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Before we get to the questions, I want to welcome our colleague, Representative Barnhart, who chairs the House Revenue Committee. We invited their committee to attend, and we're very pleased to have you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very pleased to be here.
This is very interesting because I see in California a very strong regulatory component that I didn't really pick up. I mean, I saw a market-based component in your, and so that's a very interesting nexus. Is there a regulatory piece to the REGI system in the Northeast?
Well, each state had to, in the first instance, adopt regulations to embrace this program and the participation in it. But after that, it really does rely on market forces. And so I think that this is the design of the electricity portion of the California model is very similar. The Northeast states have a dirtier fuel mix than you Western states do. And so in our part of the world, the electricity is the biggest source of emissions. And so, and we use competitive markets for our electric system in the Northeast. That fact, though, I don't think affects this program because it's very similar to California's is that part.
Okay. The other thing that I wanted to pursue with you is when you talk about the you know, giving the benefit to the ratepayers. Does any of that benefit include efficiency measures, or just is it just price offsets?
Mm-hmm. So in California, we have reasonably well-funded energy efficiency programs at the electric utilities. Those funds come from a small surcharge on the ratepayers. So that has not changed. So we're not substituting the cap-and-trade proceeds in the electric sector to offset that bill surcharge that is already funding energy efficiency. So instead, recognizing that the carbon price increases the electricity price a little bit, as was discussed before, the primary purpose of using those revenues is to essentially make the customers whole, because they know their bill's going to go up a little bit, so this is a payment to offset that increased payment for the actual electricity. The California Public Utilities Commission had to design that piece because it's a rate-making element. And for residential customers, the majority of that is as a lump sum unrelated to the amount of electricity you use, so that it's not just a one-to-one offset. You pay a little more, you get it back. But there's still the incentive with your higher price to try to use less electricity, and then you get this lump sum recognizing the benefit for the ratepayer, so it offsets. So if you end up being someone who has been able to invest and use a lot less electricity, you actually make out better, right? And then if you're someone who uses a lot of electricity, you're going to pay a little bit more and you don't quite get everything back. But that's the incentive for you to try to be more efficient.
Could I just add one thing to that? In the Regi states, one of the things that some of the states did was give a disproportionately high amount of the bill credit or the energy efficiency programs or other things targeted at low-income customers because of the expectation that having that even tiny 0.7% price increase, that it would be harder for them, and so that there was that targeting to deal with a redistributive issue.
Yeah, and the same is true in this design in California. There are other restrictions on rates for low-income customers, and so that also had to be factored in. But then there's also customer classes because, of course, you have industrial, residential, small commercial, large commercial. So each of them had a mechanism by which this proceeds got returned to them. So it's a little bit more involved, but the general approach was that.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. All of this is very interesting, and I'm really pleased that I got in on most of the presentation from California. I heard the one from Regi yesterday at the House Revenue Committee. The question I have, and I think one of the questions that comes up as you look at all of these kinds of schemes, is what effect does it have on the economic activity in the state? You already mentioned traded sector issues, and it may be early yet, but I'm assuming you're working on trying to figure out how these rules that you've put in place affect the economy in the state of Oregon. And part of the thing that we're finding, which is kind of a little surprising, maybe counterintuitive, is that when you set up the incentives correctly, as British Columbia appears to have done, it may actually improve the economy in a place where fossil fuels are imported rather than produced. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about that kind of question? Any answers yet?
So this, of course, is fundamental to the whole discussion in California about how to design these programs and, to some extent, whether to do them at all, of course, because we want to understand what effect it has on the economy. California is in part a resource extraction state, as I would refer to it. We have a substantial amount of oil and gas production within the state. We also refine a lot, and we import crude oil from around the world. So we have a pretty diverse economy. Overall, in doing the analysis before the programs started, there was a range of studies looking at the different elements of the program. For example, the clean car regulations to improve the to reduce the emissions from automobiles appears to pretty substantially produce savings within the state. The savings are not trivial; they're substantial, and that has a positive economic impact. When we look at the industrial sector, what we find is that there's opportunities for improved efficiencies, and the extent to which we are sort of substituting one set of inputs for another, we can create jobs within the state, similar to the type of substitution we were hearing before. If you substitute things like improved efficiency and insulation and other things for fossil fuel, the net jobs could be a plus, right? Because producing and using fossil fuel does not have a lot of jobs associated with it, whereas the things you're substituting for it by changing the relative prices, even just little amounts, through a carbon fee, a carbon price, can have positive effects. So going into the whole study, and we did quite in-depth analysis of our scoping plan. That was the plan that laid out the full set of programs. There was a range of estimates from positive to negative, right? But all the changes were relatively small, in fact, very small on net compared to the size of the California economy. So the question then became one of how do you manage these programs to maximize the benefit, avoid the downside, and get the upside? And that's what we're working on now. And I think I would agree with the presentation about Reggie that the manner in which the proceeds from the auctions are used will affect whether you end up in a plus or minus situation. And that's why I think our legislature decided that a three-year investment plan was needed and that the legislature would ultimately appropriate those funds into those projects. And I think it's with a mind toward managing those funds in a way to maximize benefits that they called for that. So the Air Resources Board, just to be clear, the Air Resources Board does not control those funds. Air Resources Board runs the cap and trade program, holds the auctions, the proceeds come in, they go into a special fund defined by the legislature, they sit there until the legislature appropriates them. And it's not ARB's money, it's the state's money. I might also just say, while I'm rambling a little bit here, that under California law, the proceeds from the auction are not eligible to be used as a source of general revenue for the general fund. It's a special purpose set of proceeds that come from this program. It's considered a fee and has to be used for the purposes of the program. And so it's not eligible just to be used in the general fund.
Madam Chairman, could I just amplify one thing that occurs to me to mention that came up in our conversation yesterday. Clearly, one of the things that a state is concerned about is disadvantaging your own economy relative to other states that don't have a price on carbon in one form or another. And Michael was just describing that, and of course that was really of concern to people in the Northeast. I told the committee yesterday at the House hearing that starting in 2016, every state in the United States will need to be doing something to affect the carbon emissions from power plants. And so as you look ahead and think about this, Oregon will have to be preparing a state implementation plan to respond to the Environmental Protection Agency's rules that are coming up in the future, proposed for the first time in June of this year, of how a state will address fossil fuel power plant emissions. And that will provide you with a window of opportunity to think differently about this advantaging or disadvantaging your states, because each state will be having to do something on the power sector.
And I just had a brief question. The Reggie states have done analysis of the effects on employment and the economy. Do you have anything like that in California?
So what we have in California on the economic impacts is all our analysis in advance of the programs being put in place. The cap and trade program in particular has only been up for a year, and we haven't invested any of the proceeds from the auctions, so we do not yet have a ongoing assessment of the impacts.
And how much is in that account? Yeah,
so we've held five auctions with a mix of allowances being auctioned, and this is the proceeds that go to the state, not the proceeds being used for purposes of electricity ratepayers. That's separate, but the amount going to the state is $526 million to date.
That's a nice chunk of dough. Yeah, and just that for energy efficiency.
Right. So So just to put that into context, our annual budget for the state of California is a little over $100 billion, with total, including all fees and everything, about $140 billion. So I just wanted to put that $526 million in the context of the overall state budget.
That's it's right. A big state.
We have to keep remembering it's what's the eighth largest economy in the world.
In that order, yes.
All right. Other questions? Senator Hess.
Thank you. I was looking at your website, and I was noticing there was quite a bit of enforcement, tracking, and collusion, and anti-fraud, and I guess you have to have that. How big of a part of that operation is that, this sort of law enforcement part of it?
Well, I can speak for the REGI program. Each auction has a market monitor looking at that question, and our regions have market monitors looking at the whole competitiveness of the electricity markets generally. It has been, each of the reports has shown that there has not been a problem, but it is a part of the administration of the program.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, if this has happened, collusion.
No, it has not been found to be a problem.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And
thank
again,
you.
And thank you for coming. This has been very, very interesting.
Good luck with your program.
Thank you.
Your study. Thank you.
Okay. We are going to take a brief moment here to do some bill introductions before we move to our next panel while we have a quorum.
Oh, that's a good idea.
You don't want to stay for communications, Bill? You don't want to stay for the communications panel?
I probably will. Yeah. I'm going to let you do that.
Okay. All right, I will open a work session for the purpose of bill introduction. Dr. Warner.
Madam Chair, you have three LCs in OLIS, and of course, for the short session, you're limited to the introduction of three drafts. Those are LC 273, which is really comes to us from the Treasury. And it's strictly a cleanup bill for legislation that was passed in the 13th session. And so that will take care of the concerns that the Treasury had. They reviewed the LC. LC 274 is related to your next topic. It's basically a placeholder bill for any actions you may want to take around the local taxation of telecommunication providers. And LC 275 is a cleanup bill for House Bill 3601 from the special session. So you heard some testimony on that in November about certain glitches that came up. This LC 275 will address those glitches, and we have a few more glitches, too. We may add to that as well.
Okay. Can we do these in one motion? Senator Hess, would you make a motion on this, please?
Madam Chair, I move that the committee adopt for consideration LC 273, dated January 6, 2014, LC 274, dated January 3, 2014, and LC 275, dated December 13, 2013.
Thank you. Senator Hess has moved that we introduce his committee bills, LC 273, LC 274, and LC 275. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We will close the work session, and we will open an informational meeting on the background information on local taxation of communication providers.
Did you already
sign? I did. Oh, okay. I'm on top of it.
Good.
Well, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as Paul mentioned, the legislative concept 274 was intended to be a study bill for this issue of the way that incumbent and competitive carriers of telecommunications companies are taxed or charged franchise fees. And so today, to talk more about the issue, we have a panel consisting of Mike Dewey, Barb Young, Doug Cooley, Brent Wolf, Greg Diamond, and Doug Denny. And additionally, that's from the various telecommunications carriers. Additionally, we have Craig Honeyman and Elizabeth Howe from the League of Oregon Cities. They have in the OLIS, there is an example of House Bill 2455 that was taking up this issue in the last session, and the latest version of that was the Dash 7 amendment. And additionally, there is a franchise fee survey also available in OLIS so that you can see that the different franchise fees that are charged by the various localities.
Okay, I think we're going to start out with the providers. We've got more people lined up for this than we have chairs. So why don't we try for one representative from each of the provider groups and see if we can maybe pull up another chair, get four people up here. Barb, is Barb here? Yeah, there you are. And then as time goes on, feel free to call on people who aren't up at the dais. We'll be real flexible here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. Perhaps the best way to do this is Mr. Cooley would go first. I would briefly speak second. Mr. Diamond, who are the proponents of legislation. And then we have this, the ILECs, which are affected by this bill, and Ms. Young. That might be the most effective way to put the issue before you, if that is okay with
so
you.
That's fine, and I think we can start off in that order, and then we can move the ILECs up to the dais.
Sure,
and you all are
appreciate
finished.
That.
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Cooley from Comcast. I appreciate you taking some time to listen to this important topic. This has to do with telecommunications and the use of the right-of-way. And it's kind of another one of those examples where statutes have not gone as fast as the marketplace has changed in those services and those practices. But it does go back to 1989 when the Oregon legislature passed a bill that put a cap on the fees that cities can charge for use of the right-of-way, and that limitation was 7% of the local dial tone revenues at that time. Since 1989, other companies have begun to offer telecommunications services. Companies like Comcast and others that you'll hear from today as competitors to the incumbent phone companies. We offer dial tone and other services that are related to voice and other services like that, but because of the way competitive companies are defined, that limitation on local privilege taxes does not apply to our services. Therefore, cities can essentially charge without a cap for all of the various services of telecommunications that we offer, not just dial tone. So there's this disparity in the way that the local privilege tax is applied. We discovered this, or at least my particular company came across this, when we bid on a telecommunications service and won that bid, and then the city in the example said, well, that's wonderful, we'd like you to start paying the telecommunications tax on those services that you just won the bid on. And we said, well, the previous provider was not paying that, and they said, that's true, but that's the state statute, and they were right. So we that was brought to our attention, and since that time, which has been almost 2 years ago, not quite 2 years ago, we've been trying to find a solution to simply find parity, equal treatment, and that's really what we're looking at here, is a way to go back and fix this disparity that's developed since 1989 and the change in the marketplace. So we appreciate you taking the time to look at this. It is important to us. It is time-sensitive to us, that something get resolved, because each day in a rapidly moving marketplace, this disparity has a large effect on our business, on our offers, and on our practices. So we appreciate your time. We also appreciate the time of the phone companies, CenturyLink, the Telephone Association, and Frontier, that have continued to work with us and help us to tumble some of the numbers and come up with a solution. We appreciate their compromise and their teamwork as well. So that's all I really had to share to sort of introduce the situation. If you have any questions, I can probably come up later. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and we very much appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion. Representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association, Representative Barnhart, Chair of the Revenue Committee, has been involved in these discussions for quite some time. Also, I want to thank the competitive providers for having conversations with us other than the cable companies and Ms. Young and the ILEX, which are the incumbent telephone providers, and also the cities, because we've had numerous conversations. In part, we believe the statute is inconsistent with the 96 Telecom Act because it is anti-competitive and, quite frankly, discriminatory. Now, we were cognizant of this legislation in 1989. I was here representing the Cable Association, but we weren't providing telephone service at that point, so we didn't weigh in on the legislation. But obviously, almost all of the cable companies now provide voice service, as they do video and high-speed internet. We think there is a fix to this. This would be a gross revenue test, and in the neighborhood of 4 or 5% of gross revenues. The default for us is usually, for the cable companies and others, 5%. Mr. Cooley has provided you a graph that shows the disparity in terms of the revenue requirements that we're required to pay the cable companies compared to the ILEX. And the ILEX have come forward to say that we're willing to pay more because we think this ought to be fixed, and we appreciate that very, very much. Quite frankly, the politics of this issue is unfortunate in the sense we're kind of caught in the middle, in that the ILEX would like to have a cap, and I think you'll hear from the cities, and I understand their point of view, they do not want a cap. And at some point in time, we have to figure out how to fix that. We also want to be sure that for cities that have a revenue scheme in the right-of-way that where they might lose money, City of Eugene, for example, we would grandfather in those cities that have already put something in place that is different than the 7% cap. We're willing to go down that road and fix that. I would just end by saying, for Senator Hass, for example, if he started his PR firm in 1990 and not 1989, and somehow there was a statute that said, well, you're going to pay a little higher tax than your competitors, that probably would be something that needed to be fixed. And I think it's equivalent in the sense that regulations and law often don't catch up to the technology, and this is where we need to figure out a way to do that, similar to central assessment, where we have a 73 statute that is in play in litigation. So we appreciate very much the discussion. We're willing to continue to have that, but we're to some degree running out of time, and it's very difficult for us to go city by city to change this. It's very, very hard for us to do it. We think the legislature ought to act. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senator Haas, and Representative Barnhart. My name is Greg Diamond. I'm a Vice President of Regulatory and Legislative Affairs for TW Telecom. I really want to thank you so much for the opportunity to address you this morning regarding taxation on competitive communications providers. I'm speaking today not only for TW Telecom, but also for two other competitive local exchange carriers, Integra Telecom and XO Communications, and we sort of occupy a different category. We're creatures of the 96 Act, and we're competing with the incumbent carriers, we're competing with the rural carriers, and with the cable companies. And I think that I would agree with the comments from Comcast and from cable that we're really looking for a level playing field here. TW has been providing service in Oregon for well over 10 years, and we provide a range of services, including voice services, business Ethernet, data, and Internet access. In order to provide these services, we rely heavily on the use of facilities that we place in the public right-of-ways, and it's obviously subject to a variety of local franchise and privilege tax ordinances. In recent years, we've renegotiated franchises with the cities, and where we've been providing service for well over a decade. In addition, TW Telecom is expanding its geographic reach in Oregon and has been negotiating franchises in a number of additional cities. And a recent example is the city of Newburgh, where we wanted to serve an anchor institution in that town, and it was a partnership with the city. They appreciate the fact that the institution is there, and we were able to serve that customer quickly with the help and cooperation of the city. Some of these cities are in metro areas. Some are in more rural areas. We certainly don't just serve the Portland area or the I-5 corridor. Integra and XO also provide voice, data, and Internet-related services in a number of cities in Oregon and are subject to the same franchise and privilege tax requirements. Unfortunately, the current scheme is flawed. As mentioned, we believe it's discriminatory and anti-competitive. Section 221.515 of the Oregon Revised Statutes places a 7% cap on the privilege taxes cities can impose on incumbent local exchange carriers. The statutes restrict the revenues upon which that 7% privilege tax can be imposed to only the local dial-tone service revenues of the ILEX. The problem is that the statute provides no restrictions on the privilege tax that a city can impose on a competitive carrier like TW Telecom, nor on the types of revenue that can be taxed. In practice, most cities in Oregon have imposed privilege tax schemes that tax the entire gross revenues of competitive carriers and only tax the local dial tone revenues of the ILEX. So this does have an impact on the marketplace. New entrants, competitive carriers like TW Telecom, Integra, and XO pay the tax on a wider array of services than the ILEC. As a practical matter, this means that when we bid to provide services to a customer in direct competition with the ILEC, our bid will reflect a higher tax burden because the incumbent carrier only pays privilege taxes on the local dial tone portion of the bundle of services, while TW Telecom is required to pay a privilege tax on all of the services in the bundle. This impact is exacerbated when the bid is exclusively for non-local dial tone services. Take the example of a customer that needs a dedicated point-to-point circuit to carry all of its traffic from one of its offices to another. The ILEC pays no privilege tax on that service offering. Well, my company is required to pay, depending upon the city, between 5% and 7% privilege tax on that service offering. The incumbent provider automatically has up to a 7% advantage in the pricing of its service. This result stands logic on its head. The new entrant, which is competing to edge its way into a market traditionally dominated by the ILEC, is handicapped against the larger dominant carrier. The tax scheme, quite honestly, as mentioned, is really inconsistent with the public policy goals advocated or promulgated by the Telecommunications Act of 96. It's that Section 253 of the Telecom Act expressly prohibits laws that erect barriers to competitive entry. But we're 18 years since passage of the Act. We have a statute in Oregon that protects the incumbents and handicaps new entrants. The legislature really should act to remedy this situation. There is simply no rational basis for treating the ILEX and the competitive carriers differently when it comes to municipal taxation. TW Telecom, Integra, and XO appreciate that a draft study bill has been pre-session filed, but we encourage the legislature to instead act to eradicate this discriminatory tax scheme in the 2014 legislative session. Eliminating the privilege tax regime in the state will not only encourage competition, but also promote broadband deployment to other areas of the state. There's a draft bill that all of the providers have worked together to propose jointly as a compromise solution to this problem. The draft bill has several components. It would expand the revenue base upon which cities could impose privilege taxes to all retail services, clarify that voice-over internet protocol services are included, place a reasonable 5% cap on the tax rate to ensure that existing municipal tax revenues would not be negatively impacted, and it expressly ensures that the non-discriminatory treatment of all providers. We believe the bill represents a fair and equitable result that will encourage competition while keeping the cities whole. It's important to note that the incumbents support the draft bill, despite the fact that this implementation will increase the privilege taxes they pay. I expect that the cities are going to claim that restrictions on their ability to manage the right-of-ways will erect an insurmountable obstacle to privilege tax reform. However, the cities have had state-mandated caps on privilege taxes for decades. As mentioned, the 1989 enactment of the 7% cap on the privilege tax on incumbent local exchange carriers was merely a revision of the 5% of gross revenue cap on telecommunications-related privilege taxes that were part of a more comprehensive privilege tax cap statute relating to other utilities, including gas and electric. The cap on gas and electric privilege taxes remains in place to this day. The cap has not unduly hindered the ability of the cities to manage their right-of-ways, nor has the existing cap on privilege taxes on the incumbent LECs. There is no reason to believe that reforming the existing capped privileged tax scheme to eliminate inherent discrimination would somehow hamper management of the right-of-way. TW Telecom, Integra, and EXO urged the committee to consider the draft compromise bill drafted by the providers during the coming legislative session. Thanks very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll hold questions till we finish the panel.
Chair Burdick, committee members, my name is Barb Young. I'm the legislative director for CenturyLink in Oregon. I just have a few brief comments. Most of the history has been covered, and also a good description by TW Telecom with regard to kind of the consensus bill that we've been working on over the interim. We did make a commitment, both OTA, myself, and Frontier, at the direction of some of the folks on this committee, plus leadership, to work during the interim to see if we could come together and agree upon language that would address different tax treatment with regard to franchise fees that are currently in statute. We did that. And what we have come up with is just as was described by TW Telecom. It is a bill that would keep a cap in place of 5%. It would expand the base to gross retail revenue. We do not believe wholesale is appropriate to include in the revenue base. It also would, as was asked, would take a look at perhaps carving out cities such as Portland and Eugene, and actually the draft language that we just recently put together and has not been shared yet with the committee. Frankly, I've not gotten a response back from Cable if they agree to the language, would base that carve out on a population of 100,000 or more. So it retains the existing tax structure in place for Eugene and Portland, although the Portland tax structure is now currently under litigation, so still no final decision on what that will look like. I think there's a little bit of misrepresentation in that we would support this bill. What this draft does is get us to neutral on this effort. I mean, there's not, frankly, a lot in it for my company, but it does. I did keep my commitment that I would work on this and come to an agreement, and have done so. With regard to the 7%, I think one other thing should be pointed out. Of that 7% that we currently can collect, we can only pass through 3% of that to our customers. 4% is deemed inherent in our rates and essentially is a business expense to us. Our competitors may be assessed at a higher rate, but they're also passing through that entire, or have the ability to pass through that entire amount to their customers, should they choose to. So part of this draft legislation would has language around that gets us to parity, if you will, giving us the ability to pass all of whatever tax that we agree upon through to our customers, should we choose to. Again, we may not, depending on market conditions. The other thing that I would like to point out finally is that while this does get what we're proposing in this draft legislation does get us to parity with cable and competitive providers, it truly is not parity when you consider that we have wireless carriers out there that are not subject to this tax. You know, I've made no secret in my discussions with you all that, you know, the long-term solution to this problem that we would support is more of a statewide municipal communications tax that's assessed on all carriers and that broadens the base but reduces the cap. That truly gets us to a parity with regard to fees, taxes, and surcharges, a harder lift. And certainly that's an initiative that we are having discussions on right now, whether or not we can get any sort of agreement to go down that path. So that's all the comments I have. I'll turn it over to Brant.
Okay, and this we've talked about the statewide option before, and how would that work in terms of how would the revenue get to the cities in that system?
You know, the one that I've looked at a little bit is Utah, and essentially it's collected, so it's more of a statewide franchise umbrella, if you will, both for voice and video. And then the revenue is collected from the providers and distributed back to the city. So it's a statewide tax. Chair Burdick, you had requested that I find some information on what other states have done this, and there have been other. Arizona's one, and I'm still collecting that information for you to get you the whole picture of what other states have gone down this route of looking at a more of a statewide communications tax structure.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Questions? Okay. Brant?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brant Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association, and the OTA is a statewide trade association that represents many types of telecommunications companies. CenturyLink is our largest member, all the way down to Helix Telephone Company, which has just a couple of hundred access lines in northeast Oregon. I agree with most of what's been said here, all of it. In fact, Just to reiterate some of what Barb said, the compromise bill truly is a compromise bill. There are parts of that bill that we like, extending it to VoIP, voice over internet protocol services, keeping the cap in place. We agree with those things. Those parts of the bill that we don't like necessarily, we're willing to turn a blind eye to those, the increased taxes to our customers. Just to demonstrate that this is not just about large companies operating in large urban areas, a fine example of how keeping a cap in place would be beneficial to a small emerging company is as follows. Jervis Telephone Company, just north of here, is a very small telephone company, 6 to 8 employees. In an effort to remain relevant and to expand their business opportunities, they've formed a CLEC data vision. They wanted to come to the Salem area to grow their business. Initially, there was a $10,000 application fee to pay to the city of Salem before they ever signed up one single customer or plow one inch in the city. They had to pay a $10,000 fee. If they had to combine that fee with some kind of unlimited franchise fee in perpetuity that they would have to pay to the city of Salem, I can pretty much guarantee you that would stop them dead in their tracks. And that's why the effort to remove any kind of limit on a franchise fee, the effort to eliminate the franchise fee statute in its entirety, stopped us dead in our tracks last session. That is a non-starter for us. We believe that the legislature has a public policy interest in maintaining those caps. There are other fees that we collect from our customers that have caps. 911 fee has a cap. Residential Service Protection Fund fee has a cap. There are other fees that have caps. If those entities that want to increase those fees want to do that, they have to come to you, the legislature, and demonstrate their case and you have to go along with that tax increase. We see no reason to make any distinction between the cities and any other entity that might want to do that. So there. That's what I had to say on that.
Could you be a little more clear?
I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I was remiss on asking questions before because we were going to wait for the whole panel. Is there anybody else who wanted to testify as part of this panel? Come on.
Just briefly, since I'm here, I'm Doug Denny from Integra Telecom. You know, and we're a local company. We're the offices in Portland. You know, I live here and work in Oregon. And just we support that. We really encourage the legislature to address this issue. And Mr. Diamond covered a lot of our, you know, kind of concerns, but we just wanted to offer our support in that.
Thank you for weighing in. So we'll open up the whole provider issue for questions now. And if somebody has a question that they're not at the dais, they can come on up. So either of you have any questions? And I've been so immersed in this. But I do look forward to getting some of the information that you're gathering, Barb.
Madam Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
I don't know that it is appropriate for today, but I the last point that you made about the issue of competitiveness and the ability of providers to move into new markets is potentially a significant one. I would like to understand it better, and I think that probably means some offline communications just so I can get my head around that issue. It's one that I have to tell you I frankly have not thought about very much.
Absolutely.
So just to let you all know that that's going to be an issue of interest to me. I am very interested in competition in opening up telecommunication services, including internet and other things, to the public in ways that allow competition. And to the extent to which any of these systems that we're putting in place make entrance into a market more difficult, that would be an issue for me. But I have to tell you, frankly, I don't understand it, so I'd like to know more. And thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to broadcast that to the people interested.
Good.
Chair Burdick, if I could respond.
Yes, please.
Representative Barnhart, one other issue, too, that you know, I know you and I have talked about, you know, CenturyLink does business in 37 states, and we have, as most companies do, a finite amount of capital. And so you make decisions based on where you're going to make your investments on a lot of different, you know, a lot of different levels. But certainly in this state, you know, one of the initiatives that I see evolving, at least for this year, is economic development, particularly economic development in rural areas. And a lot of that is driven by broadband deployment. So when you start to look at all the things that a company my size considers on, do I invest in Oregon, do I not? And there are a lot, you know, a lot of it's the regulatory atmosphere, but some of it definitely has to do with what is the tax structure. And so, you know, is any movement on this going to further restrict our investment in the state? I can't tell you that it would for sure, but I can tell you that it would be another thing that we're taking a look at. So I appreciate your question. It's not only now entering into a new market, it's where am I going to invest in this state? And I don't want Oregon to be number 37, right? That's not good for any of us here. So,
right. Could I quickly respond to that? A big chunk of my district is rural. I completely agree with you that having a very strong broadband is critical for small businesses that want to increase their reach. In Paisley, when I last visited there in eastern Oregon in Lake County, there was one international business. It had one employee, the owner, and they made decorative saddles. And the only reason that they were in the business is because they were able to do it over the internet. So it was critical. It was critical to them. I live in a place where there is, in effect, only one, maybe two high-speed internet providers, using high-speed the way I define it rather than the way your company defines it. And it doesn't include your company. I would very much like if a business, maybe yours, maybe somebody else, provided more competition in the place where I live. It might either improve services or lower costs or prices to me. Either of those would be welcome. So I appreciate the comments you made very much about how it is that a large business like yours makes determinations about where to invest.
Okay, let's move on to our city panel. Now, we had invited the City of Portland to participate in this because they've taken an unusual, or at least a different approach to this whole area, and they declined to participate because of ongoing litigation, which I completely understand. So hopefully we'll be able to get some insight into what the city has done through the league, which represents them. So welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Honeyman. I'm legislative director for the League of Oregon Cities. We represent all 242 cities in the state of Oregon. With me is Len Goodwin, public works director for the city of Springfield. Madam Chair, you mentioned Elizabeth Howe from Eugene. She's welcome to join us if you wish.
Come on up, Liz, if you like.
We appreciate the opportunity to discuss this franchise issue with you. Initially, I was going to show you a brief video, but I think in the interest of time and avoiding duplication of message, we'll suspense with the video and I'll move on. Let me just say at the outset, Madam Chair and members of the committee, don't take my testimony as in any sense of being unwilling to continue these discussions. This is an important issue, as has been commented on by prior witnesses, and I thank you for Senator Burdick for facilitating this discussion. It's one that needs to continue. So let's delve a little deeper into right-of-way management and franchise fees. First and foremost, I want to remind the committee that rights-of-way are in the public domain, and they are an asset that cities manage for the benefit of the public, both the service providers who access them and the citizens of a city. Space in the rights-of-way, both above and below ground, often are utilized by utilities for the efficient and cost-effective delivery of services. It's much easier for them to deal with one city, one entity, a city, rather than negotiate with private landowners for rights-of-way. And just as any business does, they purchase or lease space for an office building or other facility, so too do the utilities in our rights-of-way pay rent, or in this case franchise fees, for the use of a public right-of-way. To do this, cities negotiate franchise fees and agreements with utilities containing terms and conditions. The second thing I want to impress upon you is that the League is committed to the principle of fair and equitable taxes and fees. Thirdly, we oppose attempts to modify or do away with the city's ability to control their own destinies through preemptive legislation or regulation. Another thing I want to impress upon you is that revenues from franchise fees are slowly but inexorably declining. We periodically conduct a study of statewide franchise fees. The last one we published in March of 2012. I've provided you with a copy of it. There are 145 cities who responded to the survey, and it's a fairly representative sampling of populations in Oregon. The analysis shows a drop in telecom franchise fees revenue of $1.3 million over that three-year period, or about 17%. Now, the revenues received from the incumbent carriers, typically the larger companies, has declined by about $1.9 million, while revenues collected by from the competitive carriers has increased by about $500,000, sort of evidence of the imbalance that has brought us to the table today. The tables in that report will show you city by city how the franchise fee, franchise agreements are constructed, the rates, et cetera, between the so-called ILEX and CLEXs. So let's return to my earlier stated principle about equitable taxation. The current method by which cities charge telecommunication companies violates that principle. You've heard about that already this morning. I won't belabor it. I do agree with the comment that somebody made earlier that what this is really an example of is state statute not keeping up with technology. It also, frankly, and admittedly, deprives cities of revenues that they sorely need to fund police, fire, libraries, parks, et cetera, at a time when property taxes revenues are flat or declining. Now, Prior to and then during the 2013 session, the league worked closely with Comcast and the Oregon Cable Communications Association on what I would describe as an elegant and fairly simple solution to this inequity. House Bill 2455 was the bill. It was introduced by Comcast, evolved into the Dash 7 amendments, which I've also provided you, which simply repeals the offending statute. That is ORS 221.515. This results in a level playing field while retaining the city-provider relationships to negotiate terms and conditions of franchise agreements. I want to dispel any notion that any people might have that, you know, this is the Wild West and cities are going to charge usurious franchise fees if given the opportunity. First of all, there's evidence that we don't do that in the fairly unregulated, if you will, sector of CLECs who are not protected by statute. Those franchise fees, we would argue, are very fair and reasonable. Second, it's in the city's interest to attract and deploy broadband and telecommunications coverage or resources. It's an economic development issue. It's a quality of life issue. Deprivation of those services would hurt a city. And frankly, if cities did charge unreasonable rates, irate telecoms would approach city councils and through ordinance try to block that activity or take it to an initiative process. So let me turn quickly to the LC draft currently before you. While it's a study bill, it had its genesis, in a much more comprehensive proposals that cities viewed was fraught with complexities and issues that were objectionable. To be clear about our position, we would prefer the repeal of ORS 221515, as I previously stated, in any legislation that, while proposing a level playing field but containing caps or other restrictions on city management of rights-of-ways, is problematic for cities and for the league. One of the solutions that has been discussed is to make the basis for the fee consistent between phone companies and then cap the rate. That is a preemption that would likely be objectionable to us, but even if we were to consider the acceptance of that preemption, it creates a significant challenge for cities and for the league in terms of determining the impact on all 242 cities in the state, something that we would insist upon doing before agreeing to such to legislation or a cap. There's simply not enough time, between now and the start of the February session, or even during the February session, or I would argue by the October 1st, 2014 deadline stated in the bill to do that study. There are concerns with the LC as well, substantive concerns such as the language requiring the examination of, quote, the current statutory scheme pursuant to which a municipality may regulate telecommunications carriers. That's, to us, seems to open a whole range of issues, regulatory issues, beyond just the franchise fee issue. The LC also states that the goal of the study would be to propose a fee methodology that is, quote, uniform for all telecom providers. This suggests the inclusion of wireless telecommunication providers, which I think we all understand changes the political dynamics of this discussion greatly. So to conclude and to summarize, we suggest that the inequity between the telephone companies can be achieved most simply through the repeal of the ORS statute. We would oppose additional preemption on our ability to manage rights of way and receive fair compensation for it. We prefer the ability to negotiate in good faith with our telecom providers. And if changes are proposed, we need the time to adequately analyze and report back to you and the rest of the legislature on how those changes would affect every city in the state of Oregon. Appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I'd ask Len to follow up unless you have questions.
We'll wait until we hear both presentations.
Chair Burdick, Senator Haas, Representative Barnhart, my name is Len Goodwin. I'm the Director of Development and Public Works for the City of Springfield. I'm a member of the League's Cable Telecommunications Committee, and to do some other things related to television and cable management. I'm going to abbreviate my written remarks substantially, I think, in the interest of time, in the interest of giving you plenty of opportunity to ask us questions, which I am sure you have. Like Mr. Honeyman, I concur with respect to the bill that is, or the LC that is before you. Frankly, it's a wonderful idea. I would strongly encourage a study of how telecommunications is taxed in this state.
can it be done in between now and October? I fear not. Beyond what Mr. Honeyman says with respect to the question of whether or not wireless communication should also be involved, there are a number of other opportunities for telecommunication which are off the radar, if you will. Is Vonage a telecommunication service? It certainly is. It has no facilities, at least not in our right-of-way, but it does do business here, and it does conduct telecommunications business. Is Skype telecommunications business? Well, it certainly appears to be when you do a video call to your daughter or your son who is deployed calls you. But that's all off the radar as well. If we're going to have equality in telecommunications charges, and that is a principle I think all cities would support, it is important that we consider all of the possibilities rather than taking a piecemeal approach. Candidly, that's why we thought the original compromise that was reached when the legislature met in 2013 was a good first step. It alleviated one of the inequities, the inequity between the competitive local exchange carriers, either facilities-based or non-facilities-based. For example, Integra is not completely a facilities-based carrier, and the incumbent local exchange carriers. That's only part of the solution, but it is one of the major challenges. I think that that would be a good step forward. I have not seen the latest version of the compromise bill of which Ms. Young spoke, but there is already a compromise bill, and it has already received a great deal of review in the House, and I think we could probably move forward on that very quickly. Some of the things that I think the committee should be concerned about are the details in that bill. However often the devil is in the details. There was a comment that was a gross revenue bill, but then I heard it was not a gross revenue bill. It was a bill that was based on retail revenue. Now, what is retail revenue?
Which bill are you referring to?
Ms. Young's version of an LC, which I admittedly have not yet seen. She described it as a tax on retail revenue. A lot of the revenue made by these companies may or may not be classed as retail. What are we dealing with? That's going to require a great deal of study. It is important that we be able to look at all of the sources of revenue and how they are attributed. I have a lot of experience in cable television and have discovered that there are many things which some people call revenue and others disagree wildly on. I concur with Mr. Honeyman with respect to the issue of caps. I have had, unfortunately, that experience when the city of Springfield attempted to impose a utility tax on all providers. Mr. Dewey and his colleagues, and I appreciate the dedication of their efforts, soundly trounced that effort. I think it was 76-24. When cities try to overreach, there are forces, not only our voters, but the industry, which will come out in good defense of their proposition, and I respect their right to do it, even though I disagree with the result they achieved. They talked about grandfathering provisions in the bill. Well, mentioned that Portland and Eugene were protected. They didn't mention whether or not Springfield was protected. Springfield now imposes a right-of-way use fee of 5% on all companies using the right-of-way to provide telecommunication services. When CenturyLink's franchise expired in 2012, normally we would have imposed the 5% of gross revenue on that company. We can't. ORS 221515 prohibits us from doing so. Leveling the playing field would have been simple in our case. Repeal that provision, and then we would be able to charge them the same fee that Comcast pays us for providing telephone service in Springfield. We don't want Oregon to fall into continued economic malaise. Our cities depend on economic growth and development. Telecommunications is one very important aspect of that. But we have to keep in mind there are three reasons that a telecom company can succeed in Oregon. One, cities exist. Cities aggregate customer demand, concentrate it so that the company can efficiently and profitably provide the services. The profit that they generate from providing services within those concentrated cities makes it possible for them to provide services to the rural communities at a cost that makes their entire balance sheet work. Second, the network of cable and fiber that exists is essential. Without that, that service cannot be provided. It doesn't matter whether you're wireless, whether you're a voice over internet protocol, either facilities or non-facilities based, a competitive local exchange carrier, or an incumbent. Without that network of fiber and cable, the service cannot exist. Third, because the cities hold in trust for their citizens a large amount of right-of-way, it is convenient and practical for the utility, for the telephone companies to install their facilities. Not only is there they avoid the challenge of trying to negotiate individually with private property owners, but they already have a network of connectivity that is provided by our streets and our other rights of way so that it becomes easy for them to reach every business and every resident in our community. Those three features, which are unique to cities, all are essential if they are going to provide effective and efficient telecom service. Because of that, we think that actually all of those who use those facilities ought to pay the same fee, whether they are an incumbent provider, a competitive provider, or a wireless provider. Why is there a disparity? Nonetheless, I agree with Mr. Honeyman to suggest that this study bill go into that level of detail would create a political situation which would be unfeasible, particularly in a brief session like you have coming up in February. Therefore, we suggest, as does Mr. Honeyman, that we fall back to the original concept which the providers and the cities agreed on in the last session, move it forward, and then begin the process of a more thorough and comprehensive study of how telecommunications is provided and how cities and other governments should be compensated for the benefits they provide that make it possible. Thank you for the opportunity to appear, and I will be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Thank you. Mr.
Just
Honeyman.
For clarification purposes, the discussion of Craig Honeyman, League of Cities, not all the providers were supportive of, as you well know,
true,
House Bill 2455-7.
Otherwise, it would have been passed.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be here.
That's how we roll around here. All right. Questions? Just a technical question. Because I wasn't familiar with House Bill 2455 until I started getting a little more in-depth here. So when it repeals the whole statute, does it also repeal the part that Ms. Young was talking about where it limits how much can be passed through to customers? It didn't repeal that.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, no, that provision is actually contained in OAR 660-040-0022, I believe. Yeah. So it's an administrative rule adopted by the PUC.
That's why I brought him.
And just a little clarification here. Don't get too wound up about this study. Because this was put in, I mean, I think it's a worthy effort, but this was put in as a placeholder for the focused approach that we're all trying to achieve here. Okay. All right. Other questions? Thank you very much. We're starting to get back on schedule here. Our next item here is we're going to go a little bit out of order from our published agenda. We're going to start, we're going to open up an informational hearing and an update on the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, last session, House Bill 2510 was the latest round of changes that were made to the Senior and Disabled Property Tax Deferral Program. It provided that people who were disqualified solely for having a reverse mortgage or a five-year, failing to meet a five-year residency requirement would be reinstated into the program if they had any history of participation in the program. And so DOR has been sending out notifications to people to see if they qualify for this new extension to the program. There's an update on the balance of the program fund after the payment, and it's about $3 million over the projection. And I think this represents the pent-up repayments that happened when people were out of the program for due to the various changes, and the timing in which they come back and repay seems to be shifted a little bit more near-term. I wouldn't recommend changing the projection in the long term, because I think that this just represents a shift from those pent-up repayments to this year versus maybe next year or 5 years down the line. But today, Brunson Rueda is here with the Department of Revenue to give an update about the revolving account and the latest information related to the senior deferral program.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and welcome to this program. You're new to the program, is that correct?
Chair Burdick, that is correct.
And how long have you been working on it?
I've been with the program for approximately a year.
Okay. Well, you missed most of the action, but...
the action's still going on.
Well, I'm sure it is. Well, anyway, welcome. So look forward to your testimony.
Yeah. Chair Burdick, Senator Haas, Representative Barnhart, good morning. My name is Bronson Rueda, and I am the manager of the deferral program in the Property Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. And I'm filling in today for John Phillips. The LRO asked me to give an update on the status of the deferral program, specifically two areas. One, the financial health of the program, and also a little bit about the implementation of House Bill 2510, which you passed in the 2013 session. So the first area on the deferral program revolving account balance. Historically, if you recall back in 2010, the forecast was a deficit for the deferral revolving account. This was a result of the housing slowdown and the economic downturn in Oregon. Fewer seniors were paying off their accounts, and participation in the program was growing substantially, which resulted in there being less money to pay an increasing tax bill every November. Luckily for the citizens of Oregon, you took steps to salvage the program where other states had to terminate their program. Since then, the revolving account balance has stabilized, and this past November, after we paid the taxes, the revolving account had an approximately $8 million balance. Going forward, we anticipate monthly repayments into the account of approximately $1.55 million a month. And next November, after our tax payment, we anticipate having a balance in the revolving account of $10.6 million, a better outlook than what was previously thought. Now moving on to the second area, the implementation of House Bill 2510. As you recall, the program was trimmed back in 2011 as far as the amount of participants go. And then, since then, you allowed two groups of additional seniors back into the program. The first group was due to House Bill 4039, which allowed those who had a reverse mortgage and had recertified in the program by February 1st, 2012. And this was 1,500 people that were allowed back into the program approximately. Second and last session in 2013, you added all the seniors who had previously been in the program and had a reverse mortgage or had lived in their home for less than 5 years or both back into the program. Again, House Bill 2510. How did we implement House Bill 2510? Well, it started with restructuring the application. Historically, we have received feedback that the application is somewhat confusing, so each year we take steps to improve the understanding of the application, and we have done so this year as well. In early December, we sent a letter to all of those identified affected by House Bill 2510, letting them know that they had the opportunity to reapply in January, and that was 1,876 people. And then 14 days ago, January 2nd,
these people were now allowed to reapply for the program, and the process for that is for them to reapply to the county assessor's office in their home county. And then the assessors process that application and then send it to the Department of Revenue. And this year they are date stamping the application so we can keep track of the order in which the applicants apply, because it's limited to 700 people this year. As of 2 days ago, we had 241 applications. However, it's too early in the application season to know whether these 241 applicants are the result of House Bill 2510 or not. It's going to be a few more weeks until we can identify the reason why these people applied. Any questions?
Nope. Appreciate the update. We've been watching this program very carefully because we darn near lost it with our perfect storm a few years ago. So appreciate all your efforts. Looks like you're putting some accountability controls in to really keep track of things. So that's good. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And now we are almost back on schedule. Our next item will be the core system replacement project update, also from Department of Revenue. Dr. Warner will oversee this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as you recall, of course, you've had a series of presentations from Eric Smith, who is the project manager for the core system replacement project, and he's here to update you on where they are currently.
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senator Haas, and Representative Barnhart. Appreciate the opportunity to give you an update. My name is Eric Smith. I'm the administrator of the Program Management Office at the Department of Revenue. Make sure we can see that. Are we up?
There
we go. Thank you very much. Briefly, what I hope to do is just refresh your memory about what the project is, give you a current status update of the project, touch on the approach that we're taking to implement the system, how it's being managed, the resources that we've engaged since we last updated. I think we had a joint committee in September that we updated on the project. Some of the major milestones we've already accomplished, the things we hope to accomplish in the near future, and then just cover the scope and schedule when the programs will be rolling out over the next 4 years. If you recall, we've been working on this for a while, and our business case identified the need to replace and modernize many of our systems, primarily to avoid the risk of our ability to be able to sustain revenues in the future. It's a reinvestment in our capital infrastructure. The opportunity we have with the tools that are available today is that we can improve performance. And so there's some things we'll be doing to improve the way we do our business as these systems are rolled into our programs. Our business case looked at different options for modernizing our systems, and we happen to be in a workspace where a commercial off-the-shelf solution exists and has existed and worked in other states, and so that was clearly the most viable path for us to take. Beneath that, you can see just a very high-level timeline that we have four rollouts over 4 years, and I'll get into which programs are in each of those rollouts towards the end of my presentation. But we have already commenced the first rollout, and it will conclude in the fall of this year. The way that we're executing the project, we've contracted with the Fast Enterprises. I'll speak more about them in a moment, to implement their GenTax integrated tax system and a data warehouse. It'll replace about two-thirds of our existing legacy systems. And the total cost from when we began in July of 2009 until the end of 2017 is projected to be $89.9 million. Since we received funding for implementation of the project, we asked for $70.9 million from July of 2013 through the end of 2017. Included in the $89.9 million is about $11.7 million in financing costs, and we'll be paying on those bonds until 2024. Current project status. This is a monumental effort for the department. We've never done anything like this before. There are a lot of moving pieces. We've learned a lot from projects prior to us and projects that are going on right now. And one of the things that I commit to you is that as we work through the project, we'll keep you informed if things are going well and if things aren't going well as soon as we can. One of the things that we're engaging is an independent quality assurance firm, and they've given us their assessment. I'll speak more about their experience in a moment. Overall health as of the end of December, which is just a month and a half into the project, is that we had a lot of things in place that mitigate risks early in a project. Schedule health, they're saying yellow, and yellow means it needs attention. There's a lot of things to put into the schedule to make sure you're going to meet all of the needs of the project. In terms of the deliverables, the risks, and the budget, they think that we had done adequate work for that stage of the project to be in good shape. We also have an internal project manager who's a department employee who gives their own assessment of the project's health, too. They believe for where we were in December, the overall health was green. They also saw the schedule as yellow. There's just a lot to do. There's a lot of resources to bring to bear to build a good schedule, to make sure that your dependencies and that all the work can get done on time in the right order. They looked at the budget as yellow, and that's primarily because we have to go before General Government Ways and Means Subcommittee next month to have $13 million rescheduled so that we can continue to spend the bonding proceeds that will be sold in the next bond sale in May. So for us to have full funding for the biennium, we have to have action take place in February. Once that happens, we believe that the budget will go back to green. And then the scope of the project, we're still working on how we're going to measure that, and that should be over the next month or so. We'll have a metric for on the project manager side, how we'll measure how we're doing in terms of the scope of the project being accomplished. My personal, as the sponsor of the project, my personal opinion, it's early. I want to be cautious. Overall, I give us more of a yellow, that there's just a lot of detail to pay attention to. The things are falling in place that need to, but until we get that detailed schedule in place, which will be sometime in February or early March, that's when I'll be able to have a lot more comfort that, okay, now we have everything lined up. As I mentioned, our approach to replace the systems is to implement the commercial off-the-shelf solution, Gentex. One of the things that we have committed to is no customization unless it's absolutely necessary. This has been implemented in many other states for over 10 years, almost 15 years now. And there are inherent in the system a lot of best practices that we can take advantage of. And so what that means is we will look at the opportunities that we have, and we're already doing this right now, and we will re-engineer our business processes to take advantage of those best practices. The vendor, Fast Enterprises, is very experienced. They primarily work in our kind of a workspace, either local government or state taxation. They've done this in 16 previous revenue departments, and then in addition, other taxing jurisdictions. Our contract with them is fixed price, is deliverables based, and they will not receive payment except for once a year at the end of each rollout when it's converted over to be in live production. If it's gone live and it's working, we pay them. And so we've done as much as we can to try to manage the risk in the project that we have a successful system. The other thing we've done to try to manage risk is to put in a phased approach. We're starting with smaller and mid-sized programs. We're starting with our corporate and tobacco tax programs so that we can get our feet under us and learn about how to implement the system. And then next year in the next phase, and I'll get into more detail, we'll go with personal income tax, and the year after that withholding. So we'll go to the larger programs once we're experienced in this. I won't spend much time on this slide. I just want to show you on these next two slides that we've taken very seriously to have appropriate and standard project management methods in place. We have a governance process, the leadership of the Department of Revenue on the Executive Steering Committee. We have regular engagement and reporting the state CIO office and the legislative fiscal office, not only from a budget standpoint, but we also have an IT technical person from LFO who's very active in reviewing our work products. The external independent quality assurance firm we've hired is CSG Government Solutions, and they're very experienced in this field. They're a national firm out of Chicago. And one of the things that attracted us to them is that they have experience with revenue agencies, and they have specific experience with the state, Georgia, who implemented the same system we're implementing, FAST Gentex system. And so their experience in having another state work through this has been very valuable to us to know what we can expect and how to make sure that we hold FAST accountable to the work we need. The two other things we're doing is hiring an external project management resource to help us, who has experience with this type of work, and provide bandwidth. And then change leadership is very important to make sure the organization is ready for the software. And we're having a firm, we're in the procurement process for a firm to help us with that as well. The result of that is we have your program management plan, many sub-plans which are being reviewed by DAS, LFO, our quality assurance vendor, to make sure that our plans are adequate for the work that we need to do to be successful with implementing our systems. Transparency is very important to us, and so we have regular reporting, monthly reporting, as well as quarterly and semi-annual reporting, both to the Executive Steering Committee as well as to DAS and to Legislative Fiscal Office. And I've been forwarding to Legislative Revenue Office some of the budget note requirements for semi-annual reports as well. Very active risk and issue management process. There are a lot of risks that can be associated with this, and so we have a very robust process of doing that and putting in mitigation practices as well. From a resources standpoint, we were adequately funded for the project. Not only received funding for the project, but we have our agency's operating budget is fully funded too. So we moved experienced staff into positions. We've sought to recruit for 34 positions and have filled all 34 of those positions with seasoned revenue employees who know our systems, know our processes, and so they're engaged in the project. But because we have a full operating budget, we've now hired behind them. We're greener in operations. If you hear Director Bruholtz talk, he'll say, we're greener in operations than we normally are for a while, and we need to build that bench strength up. But we have a really good team on the project. We also have a really good workspace. One of the things we'd heard from other states is don't locate your team off-site. It's too difficult to have the instant communication you need to resolve issues quickly to keep the timeline. So when the Department of Transportation got into the new building, it gave us an opportunity with some space they were in our building. And so in the fourth floor of our building, we have a team space where the team can co-locate, which is very valuable. Contractors, I mentioned Fast Enterprises, we've hired them, finished that contract negotiation in September. They're very highly qualified for our project. CSG Government Solutions, as I said, is experienced with revenue and Gentax. And as I mentioned previously, we've completed our evaluation. We're in the process of offering who to the project management firm, and we hope to have some of those folks on board within 2 weeks to help us out. I expect organizational change leadership to be on board by the end of February. Major milestones, we are borrowing about $58 million through bond sales, five different bond sales throughout the project. The first bond sale was completed in the middle of November, and we have already been able to draw from that sale to reimburse us for the project expenses that we've incurred. We also have conducted agency-wide kickoff meetings. We had 9 kickoff meetings. We went to the major regional field offices throughout the state, gave every revenue employee an opportunity to see a demonstration of what the new system will look like, to learn more about what's in it for them, when they'll be impacted by the system modernization. And the software has already been installed. And that's what's unique about a commercial off-the-shelf solution is in late October, 2 weeks after the vendor got here, the data center had the environment ready and we installed the software and it was working. And so now what we're doing is we're configuring that software to deliver our business needs for billings and payments and return processing. Upcoming milestones, we have some requirements from House Bill, or the House Bill 5008 budget note, that we're providing some key foundational project management documents to LFO for review by February 1st. We're on track to meet that. I'll give a project update similar to this to the Ways and Means Subcommittee. And we also are providing a budget letter to ask for that continued funding I had mentioned. And also, we found early on that we underestimated the amount of leadership we needed on the project. When we were putting our budget estimate together in the spring, we only had asked for 2 managers for the project. And by the time we got into beginning to ramp up, as soon as June, we realized, oh boy, we need another manager. And so we actually double-filled one of the manager positions, and we're asking for and expect to receive 1 more position for the project so that we have adequate level of leadership for the span of control we need to make sure we're successful with the project. Soon we're entering into the execution phase of the project where we configure the software to meet our business needs, and we'll start testing that. We're also already thinking about who's going to be impacted by this in the first rollout. What do we need to do to train them? What data is going to be converted? How do we prepare that data to be converted? So there's an awful lot of activity going on right now. I know this is difficult to read here. I hope that if you call it up in OLIS or in front of you, you can see it more clearly. But I wanted to have on just one view the four rollouts and the programs that are in them. So we begin with the corporate and tobacco tax programs in our first rollout that will go live this fall. Next year, we will do personal income tax, and we'll be focusing on people who are individuals who will file. So you'll have your fiduciary, your trust, the transit taxes associated with individuals. Those go live in the fall of 2015. The third rollout will go back to businesses. We'll work on withholding, unemployment insurance, the taxes that we handle with the combined return, and some of the smaller programs, state lodging, 911 tax. And then in the fourth rollout, we have a number of our smaller programs. And so that's our plan. And that's my update. I'm sure happy to entertain any questions you may have. Thanks for this opportunity.
Given what we've been through in this state recently, here's what I liked about your presentation. Mm. Off the shelf.
Yes.
Minimal customization. Mm-hmm. Contract based on deliverables. But on that third point, I just want to make sure I'm understanding it correctly. If the system, despite all your efforts, if the system for some reason fails or in some way, then we're not on the hook to pay for something that doesn't work?
Madam Chair, that's correct. We have to accept the system before it goes into production, and we're establishing all the criteria of what that means. This is the criteria that has to be met for us to say it meets our business requirements and we can put it into live production. Unless we do that, we will not be required to pay. And in addition to that, because we're in full rollouts, we would have to give them a notice to proceed even to the next rollout.
Okay, well, it just seems to me, I mean, given what we've been through with Cover Oregon, this seems like on a different planet. And probably the thing I liked best about your presentation was the assurance that if something starts to go sideways, we're going to find out sooner rather than later.
Madam Chair, we commit that to you.
Not when the tax season is upon us and we're trying to make this thing work.
Yes. Thank you.
Are there questions or comments?
Madam Chair, I'd just like to second your remarks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Chris is our last speaker.
Okay. Now we're going to talk about food, which is very appropriate, coming up on lunchtime here. Potential benefits of reinstating the crop donation tax credit. Welcome, Chris.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The next topic is on the crop donation credit, the potential benefits of reinstating that credit. Just to refresh memories, this is a tax credit that was allowed to sunset in 2012, so it was not renewed during the 2011 session. And here before you today are the food bank and the Farm Bureau to talk about the potential benefits. And this was a tax credit that would be given to producers who donate food to eligible charities such as the food bank.
Okay. Welcome.
If you'll indulge us, we're queuing up the PowerPoint.
Technology.
For the committee's information, the PowerPoint that is in OLIS right now is an old version of what's being.
Oh, it's an old version.
Yeah, it's an old version. So there is a version in OLIS.
But that'll be updated in OLIS.
We will catch up after this.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for record, Philip Kennedy Wong, and also Chair Barnhart. Thank you for joining us. I'm Philip with Oregon Food Bank. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present to you on an issue that's very, very important to not just Oregon Food Bank and farmers, but to all Oregonians. That's the issue of hunger. And we're here to present to you our perspective on the crop donation tax credit. We brought with us here today some people that can answer a lot of questions and sort of explain in greater detail, I think, the situation that we're in, both from a hunger standpoint, but also from a food sourcing standpoint for food banks. So joining me here is Mike Moran. He's our food strategic sourcing manager. These long titles, it's like, you know, sport fields, stadiums. Ian Tollison from the Oregon Farm Bureau. And we also brought several farmers that are available to answer questions, because certainly they're the ones that can answer in greater detail about what it takes to make a donation of food. And then following up, I believe Katie Koba, Director of Department of Agriculture, offered to answer any technical questions about the historic aspects of the Crop Donation Tax Credit. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mike.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senators. Thanks for having us. For the record,
I'm sorry, Senator Thompson is here. I forgot.
Well, I didn't see you up there.
You
come on up, Senator. Would you like to talk?
Sure.
Well, you come on up and talk.
Come on up.
This is a terrible breach of protocol. How long have you been back there?
What's that?
How long have you been back there?
Oh, hour and a half.
All right, introduce yourself.
Senator Thompson, Senate District 26, here to support the tax credit bill committee's looking at today, Madam Chair and committee. I'm a pear grower from the Hood River area, and we've had several, not every year, but some, it almost seems like somewhere in the valley and the different fruit regions, there's for instance a hailstorm in the summer that devastates are the pear and apple crop, and usually they're pretty selective. It could be 10 to 20, 30 acres, maybe. Sometimes it's worse. It's 500 acres in the valley that get hit, There's nothing you can do with that fruit except let it drop on the ground. And a lot of times it's just a poke mark in the fruit, but it's not marketable. So I've had instances where folks would call me and say, Chuck, what do I do with this fruit? There's nothing I can do with it. And I've called Philip in the food bank, and they've had a process where they've actually, they are so organized now and so needy of fresh fruit that they have a system where they can supply the bins, and they will, they have enough dollars sometimes to pay the grower for the harvest costs, which are the picking costs, driving the tractors to and from, and getting the fruit in their bins, and then they haul it to the, they get a local warehouse to donate their warehouse and house the fruit until it can be shipped into the food bank system, to where they can put it in the boxes and clean it up and get it out to the folks that need the fruit. But that costs money, and what we're trying to do with this bill is save the food bank dollars and give the growers an incentive to not just give fruit through that way when the fruit is damaged, but to also make it a little easier for a fruit grower. And it's not just fruit. This is cattle, this is sheep, this is any kind of produce and meat products, hopefully, that'll boost the food bank system. But I was talking to my accountant the other day when I asked, because I think this credit used to be 10%, and I asked her how many folks, because she deals with a lot of grower accounts, and how many people are taking advantage of this. And there's very few farmers that even think about it, because if a bin of fruit's worth $100, some years that's all the wholesale market's worth, or maybe a little bit less, a 10% tax credit on $100 is like $10. And I don't know if you've ever filled out a form to go do a tax credit with the state of Oregon, but it's going to take you hours to fill out the form to go after the credit, and then your accountant's going to spend some time with it. So really, there's no incentive for a grower to do that other than just do it for the goodness of his heart. And then you have, you can do that, but if the fruit's on the trees, you also have to get it picked, and it's about $25 a bin to get the fruit picked, and that doesn't even count the fuel and the tractor and all that. That's just to get the bin of fruit picked. So this will do two things, and it really, honestly, I'm not even sure 15% is enough to get that incentive. But the trouble is, it would be really nice if it could be a higher percentage, and we're really never going to know until we go that higher percentage, and then we could maybe back it off later, because I think if it was higher, more people would do it, and then I think a lot of people do this thing they say for the tax credit, and never really go through all the paperwork and stuff to do it, but they've donated a lot of fruit, and that's what we're after with this bill, is to get more people to donate to help feed the hungry. So I'm here to support that, and you're going to hear from a lot more farmers and stuff too, but thanks for letting me talk this morning.
Thank you. We're happy to have you.
Thanks.
So for the record, I'm Mike Moran, Strategic Sourcing Manager for Oregon Food Bank. Again, Madam Chair and Senators, for the opportunity to talk to you about this. You know, I'm just going to give you a broad overview, really, of the situation in that we've seen in Oregon on both the hunger front, but also on the supply side, and also why the value that we see in this tax credit and how it plays into our strategy for continuing to meet the needs of families across the state. You know, hunger in Oregon is still on the rise, unfortunately. Even though the Great Recession is technically passed, we're continuing to see increasing demand on emergency food resources, and the recent cuts to SNAP benefits have only exacerbated that. Particularly what we're hearing from pantries is, you know, a lot of the demand for emergency food resources tend to pile up at the end of the month when people's SNAP benefits run out, and those lines are starting earlier and they're getting longer. So really, it's becoming a very critical thing that we find new ways to meet that increasing demand. Food industry donations are shifting also, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, but where we get our food is different than where we used to get our food 20 years ago. In Oregon, you can see on this map, it just maps out statistics from that are put together by USDA in their food insecurity report that they put out every year, compiled from the American Community Survey. And it shows you on a county basis the percentage of households that are food insecure. And food insecure is a term that means that a household cannot meet its monthly and annual food needs. And you can see the areas in Oregon that are hit the hardest are some of the most rural counties. What we know is not only are, ironically, our best opportunities for increasing the food supply for Oregonians in the rural counties, it's also the area of the highest need. The one statistic that really strikes home for me, and maybe it's because I have kids, but over 280,000 children in the state receive food at school under the free and reduced USDA school lunch program. Well, summertime is a big time for food banks because those kids are not in school and they're not getting those meals. And it's also a time that we can potentially avail ourselves of a lot more agricultural products in mid-season. So there's a great potential synergy there. So historically, right now our food, about 57% last year in our fiscal year that ended in June, came from food industry donations. And that really covers everything from growers all the way to retailers and everybody in between, distributors, trucking companies, manufacturers, processors. That's fairly a fairly significant change from 20 years ago when almost 80% of the food we distributed came through USDA Emergency Food Assistance Program. And as you can see, USDA is a very small percentage of our total food supply right now. We don't expect that to change. And also I would point out that the 14% that we purchase now is something that we didn't do just 10 years ago. So the ability to keep up with demand is forcing us to spend more money getting food into the food bank. Where we have traditionally gotten our food from has been primarily, as I said, originally through USDA, but on the donation side from processing, manufacturing, and distribution, and sort of the center part of the supply chain. Mostly because people make mistakes in manufacturing and processing, dents, stings, out of specs, mislabels. And all of those things would then become donations to us. Those shelf-stable items that are very valuable are increasingly diminishing as a part of our total supply, because that is also the most technologically intense part of the supply chain. And as manufacturers and processors get better at what they do in their inventory management practices, lean manufacturing, and other things, they are making far fewer mistakes, and we are getting far fewer donations from that part of the supply chain. So we're really having to look to new areas. In the early part of the century, in 2001, we started an innovative program that's now been imitated throughout the country. Picking up at retailers seems logical enough that there's stuff at retailers they can't sell. So we stop at grocery stores throughout the state 5 days a week, and that has gone in 2001 from being under 1 million pounds a year that we recovered to now we recover a little over 11 million pounds a year from grocery stores. But that is now a mature program, and we really don't expect a lot more increases in that area. We've pretty much tapped that as a resource, maybe some incremental change, but not significant change. And so we're looking now at the other side of the supply chain because, well, unfortunately for growers, but fortunately for us, Mother Nature will always ensure that there are problems for growers. And frequently things that they can't market, as Senator Thompson alluded to, whether it's a hailstorm or other factors that make their products unmarketable, but still safe and nutritious, we're looking at that as our biggest opportunity. And that's why this tax credit is kind of important to us. Next slide. This slide just gives you an idea of some of the people that we already partner with throughout agriculture. We have a long-standing relationship with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, but also the wheat growers, onion growers, NORPAC, Stallbush, National Frozen Foods, other processors that work closely with agriculture, and Farmers Ending Hunger, probably our most recent addition to our partnership, is an organization that's specifically focused on organizing growers to make donations to the food bank. So, in the short, crop donations do still cost something to the growers, as the senator mentioned, and we have growers here that can talk in more detail about that. But just because they want to donate, and I can say with absolute certainty, growers want to help. I have not encountered a grower yet that has not expressed an interest to do something and see the natural relationship that they have with feeding people. But it is not free. They can't just give everything away. Next slide. And so under the prior tax credit that's set at 10% with a sunset in 2011, it was established actually in 1977 as a gleaning tax credit for volunteer groups to go into fields and glean food, but later as it matured, it applied to all crop donations. And we saw a lot of donations as a result, probably not as much as would have been if the credit were a little bit higher and it was more widely publicized. But we do know that since it is sunset in 2011, there are growers that were donating on a much more substantial basis to us than they are today, because they're doing everything they can afford, and they can just afford to do less now that there's no tax credit. And so the only farmers that did donate are the farmers that could donate under the other tax credit. It wasn't necessarily enough of incentive for everybody, depending on what they were growing and what area of agriculture they're in and how much of their cost the credit would cover. And for in some cases, we've heard very clearly that it was too low of an incentive for people to donate, and they really were asking for us to help them more. What we have been doing, knowing that even since the tax credit sunset, we are spending more money on food. As I said, 14% purchased food last year. For us, this is a cost reduction strategy, is to work more directly with growers, recovering and compensating them for some of those pick and pack out costs. Even if we're paying the bill, as we currently are, on some of those additional costs, it's still a far more cost-effective way for us to get food into the system than actually going out and buying canned goods. However, there's going to be a limit, and we know there's a limit to how much money we're going to be able to raise to cover those additional costs. So we're really looking for additional help. With the new reinstatement, as the senator mentioned, it's an increase from 10 to 15%. And really, and I can let Director Koba speak to this, probably should be much higher if we're really talking about making a reasonable incentive to cover a far more reasonable estimate of what those additional costs are. But we will, my attitude is right now we're at zero, so something is still going to do more than nothing. So we'll do what we can. And in terms of that cost effectiveness, this slide just speaks to that. When we have to go out and buy food, the cost we're getting about 2 pounds of food for every dollar we spend. When we're actually having to just do straight purchases through the wholesale market. With this, every dollar will bring in closer to 10 to 11 pounds of food, which equates to about 9 meals per dollar. It's a far more cost-effective way for us to feed people. And on the food producer side, it does help the growers. It helps them, and it's a tough time, but I'll let them talk to that. But we know from growers and what they've told us, it really is meaningful to have some additional help. And that's all I have, and I'll turn it over to Ian Tolson.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Representative Barnhart, thanks for hearing this important topic. I think Mike did a great job of kind of going into our thinking.
Just put your name on the record.
Yes, Ian Tolson with Oregon Farm Bureau. And I think this bill really represents a bridge that spans a gap of hunger in Oregon. We have a lot of tax credits in the state, and they incentivize an activity. I can think of no better activity to incentivize than helping to feed, the hungry Oregonians in our state. And as Mike said, there is a cost to that. And I'm always surprised and quite pleased, frankly, that so many farmers, they do build this in to their business plan. I think generally those are the larger farmers, the ones that can afford it, can do it. And that's been great, that's worked. But as Food Bank has seen, that well is running dry, and they really need to tap into other avenues and really increase donations. And I think the way you're going to be able to do this is to help offset some of the costs that farmers incur, whether water costs, transportation, labor, whatever the case may be. This really does help farmer recoup some of that. And so we have a group of farmers here that can better talk to the challenges they have. And as you'll see, you know, they all feel it deeply in their heart that they do something that they're proud of, and they help feed people. I mean, what other job can you do that you can say that? And I love saying that because I help work for them, but they actually do it themselves. And it's a great experience. And reinstating this tax credit, I think, will really help. Really, Oregon agriculture, it will help Food Bank, and it will help feed people in Oregon that are having a tough time. And I think that's a very important endeavor, and appreciate your guys' support.
Thank you. And why don't we hear from some of those farmers? I think probably some of them came from some distance. So before we bring them on, do we have questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So let's bring the farmers up. Are there any farmers who have come from over 100 miles? We'd want to take those first. Okay. Come on, come all. And Katie, you just wanted to be here as a resource, or did you want to? Okay.
Sit on the end again.
We're just going off to the sides now.
Want to start, Molly?
Should we start this one? Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Molly McCarger. I'm from Pure Mind Farms. We are located just north of Salem here in the Jervis area. I am a fourth-generation farmer with my brother. We farm about 1,200 acres of vegetable row crops and various other products. 600 of those acres are for NORPAC, green beans, corn, broccoli, and cauliflower. And we participate in more than one way. We participate with Farmers Ending Hunger donating, Marion Polk Food Share directly. Salem Harvest is a group of volunteers that come out and harvest extra product that either is, like stated earlier, quality wise, or we've met contract and it's there, and other various ways. And our farm has been participating with Farmers Ending Hunger since its inception in 2006 or 7. And just for an example, in 2012, we donated 34,486 total pounds of beans and corn through them to the Oregon Food Bank. Those costs, we incur the growing, the harvest, and those costs. And NORPAC also incurs a processing cost. They donate in multiple ways. They'll donate finished product to, like, Marion Polk Food Share, for example, canned green beans, and they, if I understand correctly, have an opportunity to take advantage of a federal credit or a federal tax credit, I guess, for something like that. But for the processing of donations through Farmers Ending Hunger, it's slightly different, and they would be able to take advantage as well as us. Our farm, regardless of 0, 15, or 25%, will continue to donate. I am on the school board of the Jervis School District, where we have 84% of our kids are free and reduced. 1,100 students in our district, and 924 of them probably don't eat three meals a day. It's hard to see that. As a parent of children who go to school with these kids, as a school board member, listening to teachers talk about it, and as a farmer who grows food, knowing that there's something I can do to help. And so our family has just made it part of our mission. One of the ways we also participate is we started a pumpkin patch a few years ago, and just for fun, because I could go down to my neighbor John's, or I can grow my own. And so we started doing that and trying to figure out how to get people to come out rather than just my kids. And so we have 5 acres set aside where you can come out, buy pumpkins and gourds, and wander through the corn maze for a can of food or whatever, and whatever your pumpkins cost. And people get to choose whether they want to donate their money to the Marion Polk Food Share or Farmers Ending Hunger. We don't recoup anything that we put into it. And it's amazing how many people will then directly go to Farmers Ending Hunger's website and donate additional money. But what's more, what's frustrating for me is when I have field trips come out and kids' admission is a can of food, seeing recycled food that already has a Marion Polk Food Share label on it. It's not okay. So that's why we do it. And that's why we'll continue to do it. But I know a lot of my neighbors would, they don't have that same, you know, motherly instinct that I do to help everybody all the time, unless there's an incentive. And so I really do firmly believe that it would make a big difference in putting a Band-Aid on some of our hunger issues in the state.
Thank you very much. Let's go next and try to keep it a little short so we don't miss anybody. We're getting a little short on time.
Okay. Chair Burdick and committee appreciate being able to be here. My name is Piper Sweeney. My husband's a third-generation farmer, and I've been farming with him now for almost 25 years. I also have agree with Molly, and, you know, we in Dayton, which is near McMinnville, huge percentage of these kids on free and reduced meals, and it is heartbreaking. The idea of getting up in the morning and not being able to feed your kids as a mom is just, you know, more than you can sort of fathom what that might feel like. And so we do have that idea that we really need to help in some way. And I'm on the Farmers Ending Hunger board, which goes then to the Oregon Food Bank. And so for us, that tax incentive would help offset some of our costs. When we donate an acre, let's say, of beets, that would mean to us, if I took that to a processor, that would mean anywhere from $1,800 to $2,200 to our farm for that acre, depending on the year and the price of the commodity. But so, you know, that's a big cost. Those are real dollars to us. And so it makes sense to us that would be considered, you know, something that would have some kind of tax incentive. We would do it anyway. In our case, but then if I go to my neighbor and I say, gosh, you know, we need to help feed the hungry people in Oregon. In Oregon, where we produce all this food, we should not have hungry people. And this tax incentive, I think, would really help us to be able to go to the next person, the next farmer, and say, hey, you know, let's donate. And here's, you know, here's where we'll help you out with your costs. Because again, these are real costs. Whether I grow a particular acre and donate that for the cost that I could have taken it to market, or if it's left over in the field, but now I need to harvest it, I need to go ahead and get it into the processor. Those are all real costs, real dollars. And so I would really, you know, I just think it would make a big difference to be able to say, hey, there's a tax incentive for spending that extra money to help feed hungry people. Thank you.
Welcome.
My name is Sarah Huca. I have Circle H Farm near near Eugene in Dexter, Oregon. I have a loyal farmer's market patron here, Representative Barnhart.
And unfortunately, I have to go to my next meeting. I really appreciate the presentation.
Thank you for being here. I'm a small-scale organic farmer selling direct market. And the nature of direct market sales has a lot of excess or slightly less than perfect product, and also product left over from market. I'm lucky to have accessibility to the Lane County, Food for Lane County, and a local food pantry where I can get that product to people who need it. All of our product is hand harvested, though, so the cost of doing that is significant, and I could say that I would participate more if there was a tax credit to do so.
Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, committee. Good morning. My name is John Zielinski. I farm with my brothers just northeast of Salem. My family's been farming in that area since the 1870s. We grow apples, pears, peaches, hazelnuts. We make hard cider. We also have a farm market where we sell directly to the public. I work with many different growers who bring me produce throughout the year, locally grown product. I'm also the president of Marion County Farm Bureau. On our farm, on the wholesale side, we donate anywhere from 30 to 80,000 pounds annually to Marion Polk Food Share. And for our farm market, we donated last year a little over 23,000 pounds to SACA, or Silverton Area Community Aid. These donations are highly appreciated by the food bank and by Silverton SACA because of the fresh produce. There's so many things, you know, from the president's wife down, that everyone's talking about nutrition, the value of eating fresh produce. And I know SACA, because I deal more directly with them, they pick up twice a week from our market. They are so pleased to get fresh produce in, rather than just having the pasta or the beans or the rice off the shelf, that they're getting fresh produce that they can give to the people who are visiting them that are in need. On our farm, we rarely leave something hang on the tree. We're always optimistic, as farmers are, that the market will come up and that we pick it. It's more shelf, apples and pears are more shelf stable than some of the green vegetables. So we'll often pick everything, put it in the cooler, but the market could turn sideways mid-season and we have product that maybe isn't sellable. So to pick those apples and transport them from the field into our warehouse is $20 to $25 per bin. A bin is about 22 bushel. Apples, it's about 850 pounds. Pears, about 1,000 pounds. When the fruit gets there, then we pack the apples and refrigerate them, pack them, and that has an expense of about $110 to $135 per bin. My experience with other growers is, having through Farm Bureau and through our farm market, most of these guys are donating anyway, and they do it out of the goodness of their heart. They aren't always doing it for a tax incentive. My own accountant said, you know, at 10%, it's not worth the paperwork. So 15 doesn't seem, it's not, if 10's not there, 15 isn't a whole lot of incentive. I, you know, personally would love to see the percentage much higher. 25 or 30% would be much better, much more of an incentive. Farmers work all year to grow produce, and they hate to see it not used. If a farmer is in the position of not being able to sell part or all of his crop due to market issues, contract overproduction, minor quality issues, or weather, it would be fantastic if there was an incentive to proceed with the last bit of expense, which is harvest, and donate that produce to those in need. As I am sure others have already told you, there's great need. There are many hungry people in Oregon. One of the things I noticed in the slide earlier was that these credits could carry forward 3 years.
I think that would be a crucial element to this, because if you have crop failure, as Senator Thompson mentioned, you have a pear orchard, it gets hit by hail, you're not going to have a lot of income tax that year that you need credit on. So the carry forward would be great. Farmers are used to that, being able to hold on to those credits. We do everything on, you know, looking forward anyway. If this year wasn't good, we'll go for next year. If next year isn't good, we'll go for the year after that. And maybe finally we'll get to use the tax credit. So that carry forward element, I think, is crucial and important. My final thought is that farmers want to do the right thing. They are doing the right thing. And we're hoping the legislature will do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions at this panel? Senator Hass.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you for what you do, your contributions with or with this, without this tax credit, because it's really important to this population. When we think of the food drives, the Blues Festival, and the things our kids do, it's always canned food, and nobody shows up at the Blues Festival with a bag of apples or lettuce or something, which is really in short supply for this population. So what you provide is really important, and we'll keep going back to this drawing board and see what we can do.
I want to echo that as well. And this population that benefits from these fresh food donations are the populations most likely to live in food deserts, where it's very hard to get high-quality, nutritious food. So thank you for all you do. And we will be taking up this bill in the February session. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wanted to add anything? All right. We are on schedule, folks. Anything else for the good of the order, Chris?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, we'll see you all in February.
Chair Berger, we have Katie Koba, who is going to answer any technical questions at the committee.
No, we already asked her. And
okay.
Yeah, we already covered that. But, Katie, if you want to say anything, you're more than welcome.
Real quickly, because you're short on time, Katie Kobit, Director of the Department of Agriculture. First, I want to recognize the farmers in the state that are contributing so much to the food bank. And as you heard, you know, it's a partnership that's to be commended. The commitment on both sides is terrific. The fresh piece is critically important. And when you look at the cost of harvesting the fresh product, I mean, they can range from anywhere from 15% to 35% of a farmer's budget. So we've always said in the past that the 10% is really not a tax credit at the level that is going to incentivize some additional contribution. I think it needs to be higher than 10, and I think 15 is probably low as well. But in your deliberations, I'm sure you'll come up with an appropriate number. So thank you for your attention to this issue.
And thank you. All right. We will see everyone in February, and we are adjourned.